This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A new kind of creeping war is developing in Europe. It constantly threatens to reappear in the United States and Canada. Meanwhile, bombed cities spread across the Middle East. We hear rumors that climate change is a hidden factor driving Middle East discontent. Is it true? Our guest Shiloh Fetzak writes about deep connections hardly reported by the press. Shiloh provides research for a non-governmental organization called the Center for Climate and Security, where she is a senior fellow for international affairs. Shiloh, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, is the connection between security and climate change a relatively new discovery, or has it been building up over time?
In a sense, it's been building up over time. I think that the sort of security community has been looking at these connections, at least since the early 2000s, particularly in the U.S. Defense Department. But it's rooted in a much larger field of study that dates back more to the end of the Cold War, around looking at the connections between environmental issues, environmental scarcity, and the potential for conflict. So the framing around using climate science, which we have as reasonably reliable predictions about future conditions in the world, which is more reliable information than a lot of the information that we use for security analysis and projections, taking that understanding about the future and looking at areas that might be affected, areas that might be particularly fragile now, how these might interact, how these stressors might drive additional concerns and fragility and potential conflict risk or conflict interactions in the future. So it's kind of been a burgeoning field of study for about a decade. And as evidenced by this conversation, is starting to reach more into mainstream conversations around the future security picture. But despite the traction that it's picked up, it's still somewhat a fringe topic on both the environment and the security science.
Okay, I would really like to go through the stages with you of climate change as a driver in the worst case scenario we have for conflict right now, which is Syria. When did the climate begin to bring down farmers and agriculture in Syria?
Syria experienced an extreme drought between 2006 and 2010 that is the deepest and longest drought ever recorded by what they call the instrument record. So in terms of temperature and precipitation gauges, it was the most extreme drought in recorded history. And that led to a number of very profound impacts that rippled through the society and eventually kind of presented and had ramifications for the security environment there. So the security situation in Syria now has multiple causes, but the very extreme conditions that particularly affected the east of the country, which is sort of the breadbasket, the agricultural region of the country, yeah, those ramifications we're still feeling now, both within and beyond Syria.
So I guess it drove the farmers out in a kind of exodus into the cities, which were already crowded with other people, and that's where the mixing pot goes bad.
Yes. Normally, Syria gets most of its precipitation over the winter months, but what happened in successive years was that the rains just simply didn't materialize. And the farmers there are used to drought. They cope with it regularly, but this drought was so extreme and so profound that it was simply beyond their capacity to cope. So the livelihoods in those parts of the country were decimated. Millions of people were pushed into extreme poverty, had no assets, no way of meeting their basic needs, and really had no other option in terms of survival than to relocate to some of the urban centers that are in the eastern part of the country. So you had rural Sunni herders and farmers coming to the cities where the sort of coastal elite live. And they were living around the fringes of these cities that were already hosting upwards of a million Iraqi refugees, as well as Palestinian refugees. So they already were stretched to the breaking point in terms of their capacity to provide livelihoods and employment for people and to provide basic services such as water infrastructure. So it made an already difficult situation far, far worse.
Let's talk about the freshwater resources that come in by river. In an article with Jeffrey Mazzo, you say more than 70% of the country's freshwater resources come from transborder flows, the bulk from Turkey via the Euphrates River. What is the overall status of that regional river system? Has Turkey taken more and left less via upstream dams? Is the precipitation lower? Or how much of this, I guess I'm getting, how much is water politics and how much real climate pressure?
It's certainly both. Climate change is affecting the flows of both the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. So those originate in Turkey, flow along the border or through Syria, and then flow through Iraq and empty into the Persian Gulf. And the politics of those water basins are quite complicated, both through, as you say, from a supply side in terms of the flows and how they're affected by rainfall variability that's driven by climate change. And as well, they have very complicated water management politics between the three countries. Turkey is keen to maximize its use of the water, given that so much of it originates in the country and they have a sense of having a right to it. They're also keen to exploit the hydropower potential, which is significant from these rivers. But it's quite complicated in terms of what that means for relationships with downstream countries. And as well, the way that Turkey is building dams and, you know, choosing how to manage those resources has implications for its relationship with the Kurds in that region, and as well, its relationship with downstream states. So the fact that there's so much difficulty in the relationships and so much kind of fractured social patchwork in those regions makes managing a shared water resource very, very difficult and complicated.
When rainfall is low, farmers all over the world try to pump up the difference from groundwater. Why didn't that work in Syria?
Quite simply because the rate of replacement for the aquifers was completely insufficient for the withdrawals that were taking place. So this, again, is a way of illustrating the combination between governance issues and the climate change impact. So on the one hand, you had agricultural policies that favored growing wheat and cotton in areas that were quite unsuitable for these crops. So you had a lot of really inefficient water irrigation infrastructure, like flood irrigation or open canals that had been promoted by the government. But when the rainfall couldn't support that type of agriculture, you got farmers pumping up, digging illegal wells and pumping up water in order to irrigate their crops much faster than could possibly be replaced by, again, a real lack of rainfall during those drought years. It's a difficult situation because over-extraction from aquifers is an issue in a lot of areas, and it just so happened in Syria that they were hit with such an extreme drought that it really impacted their ability to supplement the rainfall with aquifer water.
Do we know, Shiloh, for certain that displaced Syrian farmers form part of the opposition to the Assad government or that they attempted revolution?
When the farmers moved to form sort of rings of tent camps around the cities that eventually were involved in the uprisings, the spark that really lit off the public protest that then turned into a more organized opposition and more organized uprising and eventually a civil war. The incident that sparked that was a group of 15 kids spray painted like a protest chant on a wall. They were apprehended. They were mistreated in custody. They were tortured, and one of them actually died in custody. And it was outrage at that heavy-handed response that sparked the initial protest, and that was in a town called Daraa that's in the south western part of the country. Now, the people who were involved in the initial protests were probably not necessarily rural shepherds who'd come to live on the outskirts of the tent city, but there were issues that were of concern to them, to those farmers and herdsmen, that were part of the initial expression of frustration and outrage that became part of the reasons that the protests sprung up. So whether it's to do with corruption around well licensing, whether it's to do with the sectarianism that often played into that in rural areas, it was part of the background of frustration and grievance that fueled those initial protests and uprisings.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm speaking with Shiloh Fetzak, and we're talking about Syria as a case study of how much climate can affect security. And part of the problem we have, Shiloh, in the media and in the public is the difficulty of teasing out what violence has roots in climate change. In the midst of so many other possible causes we could talk about, how do we separate climate, or can we?
It's not really possible to parse out one particular component as a cause of a particular incident of violence or something as complex as the Syrian civil war. You can never really single out one particular factor amongst all of the social, political, historical, ideological, environmental, economic, and other causes that are inherently part of a complex mix when it comes to any conflict, and particularly one where climate or environment might have been a component. I mean, even if you look at Syria and what happened there, yes, there was a really severe drought. Yes, that hugely impacted rural people's livelihoods, but it was happening in the context of other governance issues, which are very important to not underestimate the significance of, because the blame for the situation that eventually arose lies squarely with the Assad regime, and we shouldn't underestimate that. If you look just, for example, at the drivers of migration in terms of people's livelihoods being decimated, the drought was one factor. Another couple of factors were cancellation on government subsidies for diesel and for fertilizer, which both took place during those severe years of drought. And that was part of a larger shift away from government policies that subsidized those types of rural agriculture. So climate was one component in a context of a lot of other governance challenges. Those protests would not have sprung up if the Assad regime had responded in a more effective way to the needs of those displaced persons, and if it hadn't been for some of the sectarian dynamics that were at play in terms of the rural Sunni majority and the more elite coastal Shiite population, we would not have seen the particular mix of conditions that led to the uprising in Syria. So you can only really speak to climate as being part of a complex picture, something that pushes on the drivers of fragility and instability, but it's difficult to separate it out completely.
Has the drought that helped wipe out so many Syrian farms ended now?
They had a couple of dry years, again, 2013, 2014, but 2015 actually was more of a return to a bit heavier rains. However, that hasn't necessarily meant that rural livelihoods have been able to spring back by any means. The infrastructure, the trade, transport routes, and so forth have been very deeply impacted by the ongoing instability in the country. So while the weather conditions have improved, that hasn't directly correlated to an improvement in the security situation by any means.
I was going to ask you about another issue which you may or may not know about. The United States Air Force recently bombed militant camps in both Somalia and Yemen. In addition to all the obvious factors like sectarian war, the huge youth unemployment, extreme poverty, are there also climate drivers at work in those countries?
Yeah, absolutely. Both are very water-stressed regions. Yemen is a country with a burgeoning youth population and quite insufficient water resources to meet the need for basic water needs in the country. So Yemen is very water stressed. Their aquifers are dropping down. As of now, I think in the capital city, you only get piped water like one day a week, and most people have to buy water the rest of the time, which is very expensive. It's not a sustainable situation. And what that means for the conflict there is that even once, hopefully, eventually, the security situation improves, you're still going to be faced with very serious resource stress and the need for effective resource governance. And whether that can be managed and how well that will be managed in a context of a recent post-conflict society is something that's of concern. Same situation in Somalia, very water-stressed at present, projected to become more so in the future. You know, as it is, they have a hard time meeting the needs of herdsmen, agriculture. Food security is a major issue for environmental as well as other kind of political reasons. And looking ahead at a situation that could eventually resolve, could eventually stabilize, potentially those resource issues and resource stress issues are going to be an ongoing factor that will make peace building and post-conflict reconstruction more and more difficult as climate change picks up pace. So those are both certainly areas of concern where we will have to pay particular attention to looking for ways to improve the resilience of the societies to more and more difficult climate impacts.
And I think another factor is it just gets so hot that it's uncomfortable to go out. It gets to be too hot to work. The nights get to be too hot to sleep as climate change progresses. And I'm wondering, is there any study of the social impact, let's call it, of something that can drive people crazy and societies to the breaking point if you get these long heat waves with high humidity?
I think you've seen a bit of unrest around this that's taken place. Again, speaking about the same region, there were protests in Iraq when there were heat waves that overwhelmed the electricity grid, which knocked out people's air conditioning. So there was riots in the streets, protests in the streets, because this is a very essential component of survival in those heat waves. I think a lot of the areas that are projected to experience humidity that's beyond human body's capacity, heat and humidity that's beyond human body's capacity to sweat out or ventilate. I don't know that there have been any studies in particular around the social implications of this, but it's recognized as something that will be very, very difficult to deal with. Again, not impossible, because there might be ways of improving how buildings are cooled. It might just be a fact that during those times people need to stay inside. We can see it as something that would add stress to systems that are already struggling. So in, you know, Bahrain or in Saudi Arabia or some of the places that are projected to be particularly affected by this heat and humidity, it's something that if we're thinking ahead and are able to prepare for to the best of our ability, we might be able to cope with. But it's something that we need to be aware of as a potential stressor.
And Shiloh Fetzak, you also contribute research to at least one other organization. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The International Alert is a London-based peace-building organization that has a number of field offices in areas that are conflict-affected or post-conflict societies or places that are experiencing fragility. So they look quite carefully at the peace-building side of this issue around understanding how specifically environmental factors and resource factors and how those are governed and managed by societies, who's left out, who's affected by those decision-making. They look very carefully at how this will play out in areas that are particularly fragile or potentially prone to experiencing some of the adverse security impacts from climate change.
What is really happening at the Center for Climate and Security? What does the organization do?
Well, it acts as a nexus for the climate security research community. There are a lot of very valuable discussion forums that take place under the rubric of various groups that the Center for Climate and Security runs. It produces research. So they've done some interesting work around climate change in the Arab Spring, around the U.S. pivot to Asia and the climate implications for that and things that the U.S. government needs to be aware of and acting on. And are looking really kind of at the forefront of research on these topics and generating really concrete and specific policy recommendations for governments that understand that there's a connection here, who've been thinking about it for some time, but might not necessarily be in a position to leverage the specific types of actions that need to happen. So they're filling a research and a policy and a communications gap that exists.
You and your colleagues, including Francesco Femia, have sent me a good list of articles for further research. Do you mind if I include those in my show blog at ecoshock.info?
Oh, please do. That would be wonderful.
And as we wrap up, I still have the feeling we barely touched a deep subject that breaks out in trouble and violence all over the world. Is there more you would like to tell our listeners, or perhaps something that I've missed?
I mean, I think one of the key messages here is that we're about to be impacted by events that are, in a sense, foreseeable, but in a sense are also going to catch us by surprise. So we need to really focus on building resilience and ensuring that the scale of these changes, which are going to be really difficult to cope with, are met with a commensurate level of response that will leave us in a position to be able to roll with these changes, to cope with them, and to not be tipped into situations of instability or fragility that we're not able to cope with. So it's a grim and a concerning picture, but we need to ensure that the response is at a level that will enable us to cope with these situations well.
We've been talking about the climate flashpoint in Syria as a fresh example of the threat of global warming to security everywhere. Our guest is Shiloh Fetzak, an expert and analyst with the Center for Climate and Security at climateandsecurity.org. Thank you so much, Shiloh, for visiting with us.
Thanks a lot for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.